Another day, another news-filled day in South Africa, because here we are in uncharted waters. I had a whole an entire preparation done, because the day after what was supposed to have been the budget speech, here we sit dololo. Lots of speculation, and in true South African fashion, a leaked budget speech. So we know what was supposed to have been said, but nobody's saying, yeah, that's what we were going to say. And I've got two things. I got within minutes of the announcement that the budget speech is cancelled, and will possibly be postponed to the 12th of next month, I get a WhatsApp from the DA saying, we're fighting for you. And I was like, the DA is fighting for us now. This is new. This is interesting. This is nice. And then, of course, the next thing that happens is there's a proliferation of, on social media, everybody is saying something, lots of speculation. And on top of all that, by the time we go to bed last night, there is a hot mic moment with the DG, with the minister in the presidency, and our finance minister seemingly disparaging comments made by the SARS commissioner. They were like, hey, banna. So this morning I wake up and I say, right, how do we get our heads around this? How do we as South Africans get our heads around this? Because, of course, the budget would have had big communication issues, numbers for the country, but also, as always, has a downward trickle to me as a person in my little house doing my budget for me and my son. And so I've asked two dear friends to join me this morning to have these two conversations with me, and hopefully help me and you understand a little bit more about where we are. Are we really up shit creek and we don't have a paddle? Or it's not so bad. Joining me in the studio, and earlier my one guest said he is not just the capital, the high priest of capital, but as the CEO of the Free Market Foundation. My friend David Ansara is here to help me understand a little bit more around what all this means in light of markets and in light of investors, and also hopefully what he and I, as heads of our households, also need to take into consideration. So thank you for coming and spending the
Thank you,
time
Bruni.
with
It's great
me.
to be here.
And a new friend that I was in the same meeting with him when the news broke that there's going to be no budget, and I was just like, "Hibo." And we then spent a big chunk of the meeting talking about all of these implications. And I thought, this guy knows what he's talking about. He better come and chat with me. But I've subsequently to that, have also learned that Mr. Khatatso, please help me say it correctly, because it's a Sesotho last name and I always struggle. Tlhahodi.
Kakudi.
Tlhakudi.
That's correct, yeah.
Who is one of those unseen and unsung heroes of our public service, who over the past number of years has diligently worked away in various departments and possibly been among the cogs in the wheel that fought back against the bullies, fought back against some of what was state capture, what is state capture, where we are and what we are. But and interesting background, aerospace engineer, but who spent a lot of his time in the Department of Public Enterprises and has been on the receiving end of what budgets actually mean as they come down to it in terms of how the public purse is spent. And you're going to give us a glimpse behind the curtain, I hope. Welcome.
No, thank you, and for having me here. And
So
therefore invited me to come and share my thoughts with you.
let's start with this one. What the actual, first time ever in democratic South Africa, and actually, as I think about it, even in my living memory, that the budget speech has been cancelled. What does this mean and why? What are you hearing and what do you think is happening behind the scenes?
Bumi, Margaret Thatcher once said that the problem with socialism is sooner or later you run out of other people's money. And I think we are at such a point in South Africa.
Well, thank God we are a democracy.
Well, you say this is unprecedented. Mm. And the reason it is unprecedented is because we also have another unprecedented development, which is the GNU. And we as the Free Market Foundation, we're very skeptical of the formation of the GNU. We cautioned against it, actually. And we argued instead for a confidence and supply kind of arrangement. This was back in June, July last year, i.e. an ANC minority government. That didn't happen. We got a GNU instead. And a lot of people were very enthusiastic about the GNU because they thought, here you're going to have the DA and other opposition parties inside government acting as a brake, as a check on the worst excesses of ANC governance or misgovernance. Rampant spending, things like expropriation, NHI, National Health Insurance, all of these policies that have actually so damaged South Africa's economy. But what actually ended up happening was the opposite, was that the GNU actually provided a mechanism for the ANC to extend its policy paradigm. Mm. And a lot of that resistance that a lot of people were expecting just didn't materialize. But I think what's so exciting about what happened yesterday is that for the first time we actually had the DA and other entities saying, whoa, hold your horses. We're not going to pass this budget that includes an additional 2% value-added tax from 15% up to 17%.
Mm. Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit.
But, and I think that's very important.
Behind the curtain. Yeah. Is this like, does the budget always work like this? The minister just comes and it's the first time everybody hears what's sitting in that thing. Or do they work on this document for months ahead of the time? And the reason he has to present it to Parliament and we listen into it is because there's going to be a vote. The people in Parliament are going to vote about this. So why all this drama?
Well,
do you think?
It's quite embarrassing, I must say. And being privy to the process that precedes, the tabling of the budget in Parliament, I was wondering what could have gone wrong. And also, wasn't there a better way to have handled this than literally to embarrass all of us on an international stage? Because every corporation out there, international corporation, every government out there, is looking to what's going on down here. And as we know, we also have the BRICS, or rather the G20 ministers in this country. So it was a bad timing, if I may call it that. And I'm saying, being privy to the process that you have the ministers' committee on the budget, you have the departments before that would have bid for budget, that would say these are the programs we want to implement, this is the funding we require. There would have been those engagements between departments of National Treasury to say, we can only afford this, we can afford that. So at that particular, they should have known that there's not enough in the kitty and the money needs to be raised in some way. And I would have thought that the Minister's Committee of the Budget, also the full cabinet would have had a say as well on the budget, that someone would have said, we have a problem with this 2% percentage point hike on the VAT, that all those checks were missed such that on the day of the budget, we have it being pulled so that there can be a cabinet meeting. It really does not reflect well on those that we have deployed as voters to the highest offices in our country.
So I do also think, and I've been reading a lot on how people are responding to this, just the general public.
Mm.
Is this a manufactured outrage, really, to calm us down so that we can all blow up and have this big fight about it and then come back and say, okay, we've heard you. We're actually only going to increase VAT by 1%, or we can increase it by 0.5%. Could this be? Or am I just too much of a conspiracy theorist?
We hope not, because government is already struggling in building trust with the population. If that was to be the case, I think it will be very unfortunate. And the utopia that David spoke about earlier of literally no government, would basically get here much closer than we had thought. So we don't hope they're gonna they're gonna do that. We believe that that they will go back and really apply their mind properly to where the revenues should come from. And there's a lot of money in this economy, other people's money, our taxpayers' money, obviously a product of our choices that they can tap into. There's a lot of wealth in this economy that can be tapped by government to do what it says it wants to do. There's a lot of money that it's leaving our shores through manufactured schemes that SARS and the National Treasury should apply their mind to say, should it not be stemming that outflow so that it can be of use in this economy. So one hopes that the kind of thinking that will materialize from this point onwards.
Do you not think that this, I mean, when I saw the SMS coming in saying the DA has stopped this 2% increase, hey, well, guys, how quickly they got to turn this thing around, these news around. we're trying not to turn it.
Khatatso is still on his way.
But I am serious, though, about the spin opportunities that this thing has really given rise to. And there are some people who are taking good advantage of it, I think. But could it be that everybody knew this was coming and this is just another way to get to lull South Africans into some form of acquiescing and going along with all of the things that government wants to do anyway?
Look, I think the DA has to come out against any new tax increases. So even if these tax increases are applied to corporate income tax or personal income tax, they should resist that also. So I think it was good that the DA made a big fuss about the increase in VAT. Look, the unions weren't very happy about the VAT increase either, and that affects everybody. So, look, our preference as the Free Market Foundation is no new taxes, but actually also reduce taxes, because we've reached a point where any increases in taxation actually yield negative returns. So there's something called the Laffer curve, which is a principle in economics, that if you start to overstress your tax base, and we only have really about 7.5 million active taxpayers in South Africa supporting everybody else. If you consider we have about 28
well,
million.
Well, everybody pays VAT. Yeah. Everybody yeah. pays VAT. So even the Gogo, who supposedly is only getting a government grant, they pay VAT too. You know.
Yeah,
so,
but more of our tax revenue comes from personal income tax and then corporate income tax. So those 7.5 million people or so, the productive people, revenue generators essentially, are propping up the entire economy. So yeah, so VAT is actually a more equitable form of tax in that everybody has to shoulder that burden and it's a tax on consumption. But really, South Africans don't have much discretionary income because we're taxed up to our eyeballs. And what's worse is that the government, because it's been living beyond its means for so many decades now, has this enormous and growing debt burden. And what the finance minister would have said yesterday is that the sovereign debt, the national debt, would have gone up from 75%, which was their projection only in October of last year, gone up by one percentage point to 76% debt to GDP. Mm. And so that means that we are spending 22 cents for every rand of revenue generated just on servicing our debt. So that's paying back the interest and then also the principal, the original borrowing. So that we're spending more on our national debt than on things like healthcare or safety and security.
So what then, what options are available to the minister to be able to keep it going? I mean, we've got so he's borrowed now to the hilt. We're obviously taxes can't come for more places from the people. And David, you're saying we can't even income tax, even corporate tax can't be where we get these revenues. What options do we have available on the table, if any? Yeah. Maybe we're just sitting here going,
cut.
Bunjalo bafethu.
We need to do what Javier Milei has done.
Javier Milei.
He's got a big chainsaw and he's cutting all of the spending. We need to do what Elon Musk is doing with the Doge, going in, opening up all these departments where there's all this hidden expenditure, and rooting out all of the dead wood, all of the inefficient public servants, all of the misallocation of capital. That's where we are leaking money everywhere, and because we've got this bloated,
is this a speculation?
Oversized government.
David, we have had 16 years of austerity. At some point, we have to ask ourselves, where is this cutting going to lead us to? Our problem is not on the expenditure side. Our problem is on the revenue side. This economy has not been growing for quite a long time. And what this economy requires is a bit of stimuli from government. And government needs to look very closely at what a big business is hoarding in terms of capital. I mean, at some point, we heard of an investment strike, that some of these entities are not investing literally in their operations in this country. Well, incentivize them to spend. Put some taxes on those on that capital that is hoarded. Stem the flow of capital that is leaving these shores, with some of the, I'll call them phantom transactions, where these companies are being placed offshore. Mm-hmm. So let's address those kind of things. And just on the other point that David said, and that you counted, Pumi, all of us pay tax. Whether you're unemployed or not, you pay tax. All of us pay administered prices, which helped, obviously, to deliver services to all of us. So, this narrative that some of our people are not paying tax and only relied on a small number of us is not correct. And in actual fact, it has other undertones that I would not want to get into. Mm-hmm. So all of us have a stake in what happens in this economy. But we also need a government that takes its responsibility seriously. We should all really be asking ourselves, if you have a government that drops the ball like this, as it happened yesterday, what other balls are they dropping in there? Mm. Should we not be insisting really on having the best amongst us get into this government? Because really, it sounds like the worst of amongst us are in there, especially when the comments that were made that involved the Minister of State Security yesterday about one of their own colleagues. You have to ask yourself, what kind of people are these that are claiming to be representing us?
Yeah. That was, I've been talking, David, do you want to say something?
Capital goes where capital is treated best. Why is there capital flight out of this country? Why do you think that is? Because investors want to go to a country where they can invest their money and have security, that they know they'll get their original investment back, and that they can make money from the investment. So I'm not surprised that people are finding ways of getting their capital out of South Africa, but it's lamentable. We need to say, what can we do to global capital to entice it to come to this country? But instead, we apply race-based laws. We have a permission-based economy. You need to, like if you're a mining company, for example, you need to cede 26% of your equity to a silent black partner who hasn't taken the risk and provided the capital. You have to get permission from the mining minister, who may or may not grant you a mining license. You have to take all the risk. You're only going to get paid back on your investment in 10, 20 years, because that's how mining works. You need to recoup your original capital, your sunk costs. And so when you're a mining company and you look around the world, you could go anywhere. You could go to Australia, you could go to Brazil, could go to South Africa, but it's really not worth the time, and it's quite risky. So we need to find ways of stimulating and attracting capital. I mean, Mauritius, which is not very far from here, little island, they have 15% corporate tax, flat tax. Very easy. You know what you're going to get. You have many companies flooding there to establish headquarters or branch offices. We need to be doing that in South Africa. Instead, in South Africa, we think we can redistribute our way to wealth. We can't do that. We've got 28 million people on welfare grants who are not economically active individuals. Many of those people are indigent.
I think the term like economically active. I think I need you to explain to me what you mean when you say economically active.
Then those people, and I'm sure they would rather have a job than be receiving a measly 350 rand or whatever it is.
I didn't want to bring race into discussion, but you have done so. We find ourselves where we are as a country because of race-based laws. The mining industry has been the biggest beneficiary of those race-based laws, where people were uprooted to come and work on these mines, where these people were then dumped back in their homes after the mining industry was finished with them. Is that the kind of capital that you're advocating for, that really treats people as just a resource, not as people? You have a peculiar situation in this country, Pumi, where you have a national endowment. The minerals are all of our endowment. But because I bring in money to come and sink a shaft, now I'm entitled to hoard the profits of that endeavor to the exclusion of the people that are living around those mines. I grew up in Valcom. Today it's a ghost town because of the actions of the mining companies. Of course, as David is advocating, Anglo-American, where is it now?
So what about America, the people of Valcom?
In the US, sorry. It's mining in South America and everywhere else in the world. And that's what they have left behind. Because you did not have government policies that foresaw that one day that mineral will run out. But fortunately, for Valcom, there's still a lot of gold in those mine dams, and there's other endeavors that are being pursued to revive that part of the world. And this argument that gets thrown, the mining companies can go elsewhere. They don't have to be here. Well, can we have patriotic capital here that understands as good corporate citizens, they have a role in the uplifting of this country? Can we rather aim for those kind of investors? And by the way, there's quite enough capital in this country that can be deployed to get at least a mining industry amongst other industries that needs to be given injection. And government as well needs to come to the fore here. We have a state-owned mining company, AMFC, that was set up. What is happening to it? It needs to come to the fore here. Because clearly, without government playing a role in that particular in those particular sectors, I mean, the Uber capitalists that David is advocating for are being given a free hand to the detriment of our people. And the disparaging way that they have been referred to, we will not address the inequality in this country without redistribution. 70% of the land in this country is owned by the white minority that keeps throwing this thing in our faces. All when we want equitable access to a most fundamental of resources, land. So, you know, to come here and say, you know, we cannot do what was done since 1652, what was done legislatively since 1948 to address the injustices that we are now sitting with here. And say, you know, literally government should disappear and those that have money who happen to be what should be given a free hand. I don't think it's the right way to be addressing the challenges we have.
Is it a zero-sum game, though? Is it a zero-sum game? Is it either or? Is there no way of looking at all that is available and all the resources, very capital as well as human, that says, how do we, and this is back to the question that gets us to here, is there no options on the table for the minister that then says, as he says, either I tax the people more or there's nothing that can be done?
Well, if you read that speech that he would have delivered, he says he has to raise VAT because he needs to increase the public sector wage bill for the millions of public servants that we have who are not very productive, they're underworked and overpaid, frankly. And well, also
what do you,
to,
David,
to
what
finance.
What do you base that on? I was in the public service, and I work with some of the hardest working people in this country. I've worked in the private sector as well, and I've played a lot of golf when I was there. So where do you base this thing that you have these public servants that are lazing around. You know, because, you know, what I get a sense of, there's a few exceptions that you get, but everyone gets labeled with that tag. Where do you get this from?
Well, I'm sure you were very productive, but most public servants in South Africa, not very productive. So but I think...
Tell us, where...
Look around you.
No.
I mean, did you drive here today along Johannesburg Road?
Generalize on a base of it.
Well, look, our entire economy is bureaucratized. Look at something like the Department of Trade and Industry. It is this labyrinth of rules, regulations, subsidies, incentives, controls that is very expensive to run, and which places a constraint. There are millions of people. There are about 2 million people who work for the government in South Africa, and there are about 16 million people who are actively employed. So that's 1/8 of the entire workforce is working for the government. So,
We're a big country. We have a lot of responsibilities that need to be undertaken. The problem here is we need to get more people working. It's not about reducing the number of people that are in government. We need to get, and we need the right policies to get this country working. What you're advocating for, austerity, for 16 years we have had it. It has not worked. Can we try something else? Can we invest in this economy? Can we get more of our people working? Can we get those, invest in small businesses? You know, because our government, unfortunately, has been so obsessed with big business, obviously, which are the people that are funding David to do what he does. But can we put funding into small businesses, whether it is credit guarantees, more of those kind of things, simplify their access to markets, get them to get cheaper products so that they can make more money and employ more people? Can you do that? I mean, we look at our manufacturing. 80% of our manufacturing is big business. You look at the countries in the East that have actually done very well in terms of working themselves out of poverty. 80% of business in the manufacturing sector are small businesses. Mm-hmm. So that exactly, there's an example of what the country could be doing to get the stimulus it needs and to generate more revenues for itself.
Look, if you don't like austerity, the other option is growth. As you say. But we can't have state-led growth. I mean, I think what's being argued here is, we need some kind of like stimulus package. No, well, we don't have the money for that. We could grow our way out of a lot of these problems.
Okay.
Like, so if you want to have 28 million people on welfare grants, I mean, I'm very critical of welfare grants, but if you think that that's a valuable thing.
Why must
it
translate to that? Why when you say we need to get more people into the economy, you think grants? Why can't we think employment? I mean, we have seen the state, the state of our cities, the potholes, waste management. Why don't we hire more people to take
When you say we hire, who do you mean?
I'm saying as a country. I'm saying
What do you mean by that?
Obviously, it will be in the hands of government to do that.
Okay, but we just had a discussion where the finance minister said he's going to raise VAT by 2%, and then we're all lamenting that.
But VAT is not...
So where will this money come from?
The VAT is not the only option. I've given you examples of where money could be raised in terms of tax the rich. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but then the rich will leave. As you said earlier.
No, great.
Then we have no tax base.
Then we can have more land available for those of us who want to get back to the land. But I'm saying we need to do that, and that's what countries have done. Countries that have shown the way, they have done exactly that. They have cut back on the countries like South Korea, Thailand, and so on. They have grown on the back of giving people access to land and cutting up these big plantations that they had, and that's what we have in this country. You know, if people have access to land, they can at least grow their own food. They become less of a burden to the state. The surplus they can sell into the market. And that's how people make money, David. Those are the kind of policies that we need to be looking at.
Okay. So speaking of policies, I do want to talk a little bit about policies as well, you know, because as you say, for 16 years, and as I keep thinking back at every year, it almost feels, even when it was still Trevor Manuel, you know, he would talk about tightening the belt.
Yeah, he did that very well.
For years and years, we've spoken about cutting back on what people are spending. We've spoken about sin taxes. We've spoken about all of those kind of austerity measures. But very little has been spent on ideas around growth. And when we talk about growth and we talk about also, you know, there's a lot of talk about BRICS, depending on which day you're looking at the news, right? But when I look at our BRICS compatriots and what the IMF and what the World Bank and what their own internal reserve banks are projecting as growth for those countries, even in the speech that was never delivered, you know, he talks about readjusting a 1.1% growth to 0.8% growth. And that was quite shocking for me, right? We're sitting in BRICS with a Brazil that's projected at almost 3% growth, where India is sitting at double that, 4.5% growth. Even China, you know, sitting at almost 5%. And other African economies, if I look at what Egypt is projected at, if I look at what Nigeria is projected at, geez, we are very sad. Our numbers are very sad. And there are not enough ideas of what is needed in that space. David, and I know you sit at the Freedom Market, Free Market Foundation, with other compatriots from other countries. What ideas do you wish we saw more of? So not just the austerity ideas, but in the growth sector, as I say, is it a zero-sum game? You know, how can we be stimulating? What should we be doing? What are the ideas that should be seeded into this economy to grow rather than just cutting back spending?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the conversations that South Africans tend to have are these kind of zero-sum games. That we imagine that there is this finite amount of wealth in the country and all we need to do is just like chop it up in the right way and then we'll reach some kind of better place. But actually we could make this pie a lot bigger and we could generate prosperity for a lot more people. So the Free Market Foundation, at the beginning of this year, we launched our Liberty First policy agenda for the government of today. And these are a list of recommendations that you can go and download on our website.
Share Liberty with us. You have your big, here's your moment. Here's a big ad break moment, David. Just if you were at the helm, what are the three big ideas that you think could unlock growth in South Africa?
Okay, so economic freedom is really the proven path towards prosperity. So you need more economic freedom. What does that mean? People have secure private property rights. So expropriation without compensation, get that off the table. That's one
we
of our recommendations. Because the state goes wants to buy.
Yeah. Expropriation without compensation. Let's stick to facts.
Section 12 of the Expropriation Act definitely says null compensation for expropriation. Okay, but we'll get to that. I'm happy to talk about that. Okay, so you need to remove these big, very expensive policy proposals like national health insurance. We don't even know how much NHI, this big proposal, is going to cost. But what we do know is that it's going to cause significant damage to healthcare outcomes in this country and really destroy the private healthcare system, which many millions of people depend on. Not just wealthy people, but there are about 11 million people every year who pay out of pocket to use private healthcare. And we need to actually expand private healthcare to the working class and emerging middle class more through low-cost benefit options, which, by the way, the government has done its utmost to prevent those being expanded. So they have literal blood on their hands for doing that. So we also need to lower tax rates. We need to shrink the size of government. We currently have something like 73 ministers in the cabinet, ministers and deputy ministers. We need a cabinet that is 10 cabinet ministers. We need to streamline the public service ruthlessly. Because
this country has 10 ministers, David?
Norway, Switzerland, Argentina. Argentina actually is a very interesting example. They went through quite a lot of what we are going through now. They went through debt defaults. Actually, I mean, in some respects, even worse under Peronism.
Default in this country.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean that's a good point. So yeah, I mean they've had rampant hyperinflation, which thankfully South Africa hasn't had as much inflation. But if you actually unpack the inflation data in South Africa, and just think about your everyday experience, the cost of living is going up, right? Do you really think that inflation has gone up by 2% in the last year, which is the official statistics, if you go to the shops? There's a lot of those administered prices and other things that are driving that. So, yeah, those are some of the recommendations. We've got to get real here. And I think there's a lot of self-inflicted wounds that
we've heard. Yeah. And I'm going to maybe ask this a little bit differently. What we're saying is we're saying maybe the government has run out of ideas. And the ideas you are putting on the table is simply saying, the current ideas that government has had, let's cut all of these. And I'm asking for a new path. I'm asking you to say, as you sit with all of your various compatriots and you look at the situation that South Africa is in now, moving forward, some big ideas that can be seeded into the environment. So what should we be doing more of, rather than saying the zero-sum game, cut this, cut this, cut that? What should we be seeding more of? So if Khatato is saying we need to have an environment that allows more small businesses, for instance, so less onerous, for instance, rules to be able to start a business in various environments, what for Javier Milei and some of the things that he's done, what do you think would work in South Africa and how do we get there fast?
Okay, close down SOEs. So close down South African Airways, close down the post office, close down SABC. These are really not adding any function, any value to the economy. That's what Milei has done.
That's not true.
Yeah, if you think of can I respond,
David? So we can't allow you basically to misrepresent information here and you just get away with it. The SOEs add value to the economy. I mean, SAA itself has just released an Oxford Economics report to that effect. Just that the numbers don't come to mind. But
I haven't flown anywhere in a long time.
So SAA is flying and it's growing. I mean, started with 6 aircraft. They're now up to 13 aircraft. I think this year they'll be up to 18 aircraft. They are growing because there's a demand for their services out there. There's a requirement to connect us with the rest of our trading partners. No investors are going to come here unless there's a connection to this country. And the efficiency of those connections are very important. Transnet used to move about 230 million tons of freight, and most of that is minerals, obviously, that go out to be benefited elsewhere, which is not the scenario we want. They're still moving 150 million tons of minerals today. We'd like that numbers to double. Hopefully, government has some kind of a target on that. But in the first MTSF of, government, we had a figure of growing this to 330 million tons. So those are the kind of things that government SOEs are doing. They're enabling this particular economy. We went through a bad patch where we appointed wrong people, where there was corruption in those entities. But it must be cleaned up and they can go back to doing what they used to do. And we had 15 years of growth in this country. And that sometimes that is gets forgotten. We get told we have 30 years of bad governance. But 15 years, we got to 5% growth in this country. We had a budget surplus. So when government or governing is done well, you get those kind of numbers. Of course, from the fourth administration, things didn't go as well as they should have. We should learn from that and fix that. But this idea, cancel government altogether, the rest of the population can be put at the mercy of capitalists. That should not be allowed. And maybe the minority is the right way to use in this scenario. We need to be saying we need a strong, assertive government, but a government where the best of amongst us are deployed, because those people have better ideas than what we have seen up to now. Because in the last 16 years of austerity, we have not moved. and we can move a lot faster.
So can I respond to that? Because actually, if you look at the early to mid-2000s, Kakhatso is right. There was a sense of that the government must have a budget that is conservative, that the government lives within its means. So you mentioned Trevor Manuel earlier, and you correctly say that there were budget surpluses. Our debt profile in those days was about 25%. Okay, today it's north of 75%. So there was, and you know, when the ANC came into power in 94, the debt burden was a lot higher. It was like in the 60s. So they actually brought that down, and that and that sent a signal to the rest of the world, like, hey, you know, these guys in South Africa are serious. This is a place to come and invest and to make money and to take some long-term bets. And actually, unemployment went down, and you know, now it's back up above 30%. So, I mean, you asked earlier about some of the interventions. Yeah. I mean, that to me is the biggest problem that we have in South Africa, 30% unemployment. Millions and millions of people who are just...
70% amongst the youth.
Yeah.
And those are crazy numbers.
But the only way, we're not going to employ those people through expanded public works programs or the YES program where we say, okay, you people at the back of this long queue, you can come to the front. We need to... Small businesses, you mentioned them earlier. We need to make it worth those entrepreneurs' while to hire that young upstart who's climbing up the ladder. But at the moment, we have things like national minimum wage, which locks out the poorest of the poor from the labor market. We have the Labor Relations Act, which benefits unions.
We have the working poor, David. People who go to work but they don't have enough money to last them a month. And you say you're railing against minimum wage.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I think you're,
the real minimum wage looking, in this country is zero.
You're looking in the wrong direction. What we need is we need big public infrastructure programs. We don't have a public transport system in this country. And that's what helps our people. If you can get that going, if you can get PRASA, for instance, to get back to the numbers that it used to be able to move. That's a social wage. That makes people's lives a lot easier. That is the kind of effort that is required. But to say government must be disappear from the scene altogether and that we must relax the rules, then what you're doing is you're saying actually you're asking for the law of the jungle. The most powerful and the most moneyed will be the ones that calls the shots and set the rules of the game in that scenario. We need government, and we have had good government in the last first 15 years of after 1994, and we can again. And I really believe there's still a lot of very good people in our country who want to make a change and participate in this government.
Well, speaking of people in our country, I just want a small pivot to, we've spoken a lot about the macro, the big picture stuff. Mm. But when it comes back down to me in my house with my son, what does all this mean? What does all this mean where... Now it's up in the air, you know, this unprecedented time where there's this uncertainty of what comes next. So on the 12th of March, when the budget is announced eventually or tabled once again, is it going to be much of a different thing? Or are we going to just be a month later having this same conversation again as individuals going, we still have 30 million South Africans living on less than 20 rand a day. We still have 70% of our young people unemployed and unemployable. We still have a public infrastructure that doesn't service people. Does it mean anything? Is it going to change anything? Or do I just go home at the end of watching this program and go, well, fuck it, that's it. We're messed and that's the end of the story.
You know, we need another... a clap down gathering, the frame charter gathering, and that's what the national dialogue is seeking to achieve. We need views of all our people to be heard in terms of what should be the next blueprint for this country. What are the areas that matter for them? What we know for sure is that the basic things that matter for our people, you know, just having decent water coming through their taps, just having decent roads, just having decent accommodation. That is an opportunity in itself to also stimulate growth, because when you fix those things, you pump money into the economy, by the way. You buy materials, you employ people. Those are the things that want them to work for them. They want their children to get better education. We need to look at the education system. We need to look at what we are paying our teachers to say, you know, is this motive, is this an incentive enough to get the best of our people to go into teaching? Other countries have done it. I mean, the teachers in Singapore, which features all the time, you know, up there in terms of education, quality of education. They're paying their people where they even attract PhDs to go and teach in schools. We need to look at those kind of things. And I think through those conversations with ordinary people in our country, we can generate a blueprint. And I think that is what is needed. People have been hearing from the top in terms of what needs to be done, and the top has got it wrong for quite a long time now. Can you go back and listen to them? And the highest priest of capital, can they also just accompany the people to go listen to them whenever the national dialogue will be up and running?
I don't think is the national dialogue. Mm-hmm. We don't have to wait for the elites to decide about what the blueprint is. Because I would say, who holds the pen on who writes the blueprint? The people in power are the ones that structure our political and economic institutions in such a way that benefits them. They don't care about the national interest. They care about their own narrow political interests. And that's why, you know, when the ANC goes to the trade unions and the trade unions say, oh, we need a national minimum wage and we need the Labor Relations Act that protects our right to strike, who suffers the consequence of that? It's the poor people who live in rural areas or in peri-urban areas and townships.
David, why are you afraid to hear from the poor people, from the ordinary people, and the downtrodden in this country? Because you are an elite. You are an elite. You're saying we should listen to you, should not listen to them. You're saying, and you are railing against other elites, whom you're saying they'll be the ones that are holding the pen to write what needs to be done. I'm saying, let's go down there. Let's put pressure. Let Freedom Free Market Foundation put its energies behind pushing for this national dialogue to happen, so that you can go hear what people have to say.
Here's bottom line. This is what I want. I want people to make their own choices. So if somebody says, I want to work for less than the minimum wage, I don't see it as my role to tell them, no, sorry, you're not allowed to work. You must sit at home with zero rands. Because it makes me uncomfortable to think that you would be earning a low wage. Let that person get themselves on the labor market, the first rung of the ladder, so they can acquire the skills that they need to be competitive.
How different is that to slavery, David? Because we know
it's different in one fundamental way.
In this country, we have had instances where people were paid with old clothes, where people were told that I've given you food, so that is enough of a wage for you. Is that what you are advocating for? Government has a responsibility to protect the weak against the powerful and the moneyed. So a minimum wage is very much necessary. I've sketched to you earlier that there are people that, in fact, there's this term that has come, Mampara Week.
The what?
Mampara Week. Mm-hmm. I think the last week of the month, most of our people have less than 1,000 rands in their accounts because the wages have not kept up. So what David is advocating for is that more of our people to fall into the Mampara Week scenario. That cannot be right. You know, we cannot sit here and advocate literally for oppression of our people, because there are people that cannot speak for themselves out there, who are through organized labor able to at least have a voice.
So do you speak for them?
I don't speak for them. I'm saying let's give them a chance to be heard. That's what I'm advocating for.
Let's give them a chance to work, I would say, to prove themselves.
No, let's get them to be heard first. They will tell us what they want to do to solve their situation. What you want human resources, and I'm using that word very, very deliberately. You want cheap human resources to feather your nest as high capital. That's what you want, and that's how you see people.
An employment relationship is a reciprocal relationship. It's not a one-way relationship.
That's not what you're advocating
for. It's to say, I need you to do certain things for me and my business, and I will reward you for doing that, and I will incentivize you to do that. If you had to say to your staff at your company or to your domestic worker, oh, I'll pay you 10 rand a week, he or she would say, well, no, I'm not going to tolerate that, and they would leave. You're competing for talent in a market, in a labor market. So we actually – And so you assume that prices would stay very low.
Of course.
I mean, actually, a lot of people might offer such a valuable service that they earn more than our so-called minimum wage. Yeah,
laws of supply and demand says that that price will go down because jobs are not being created in the economy. And we are saying, let's allow the employers and capital to exploit our people. That's what you're advocating for. The solution lies in creating more employment opportunities in this country. And if capital is not going to step up, government must find ways to force capital. Because capital doesn't operate out of its own volition, so to speak. They get a license to operate from the people. Capital is very much part of this country. It's like, that's why we talk about a corporate citizen. So they have to operate according to the rules. And if the rules that the wealth that you are extracting out of this country must shared by all of us, that's the rule that they must adhere to.
Even that phrasing, extracting wealth. Wealth is not extracted. You create wealth. So like when Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook, did he extract billions of dollars from the economy? Or did he create new value by providing a platform that everybody liked to use?
We're a mining country. We know what a diamond has been formed down there for literally millions.
So should we just leave it down in the ground?
For millions of years, it gets extracted. Just to answer, it gets extracted. And a lot of wealth in this country is extracted. A lot of wealth in this country is generated through fixed assets, land, through sale of land, through rental of land, through production on that land. So it is indeed extracted in this country. So please let's not use the Zuckerberg example to move away from the realities of this country.
In whose interest is it that we leave all of this gold and platinum and all these other precious minerals down in the ground? How is that?
Who's advocating for that?
Well, I mean, by suffocating capital, this evil capital, you're basically preventing the benefit.
I think that we've degenerated into one very small part of a didactic conversation, actually, almost, which tends to happen in a lot of instances in the country, right? Where when we begin to talk about these bigger issues, they mostly get extrapolated to this very small space where we just walk in circles, right? And I think one of the things that, just before we close, because we've run out of time, one of the things that I really would like to hear your views on, is where to next, right? So where we have clearly come to an impasse, where there is, on a fundamental basis, something no longer working. What as the little person that is just me, that is trying to feed my family, watch the soccer, and raise my son? Where are the places that one can find a better understanding of how to participate better in the bigger conversation? Because, you know, you're talking about a national dialogue, and a lot has been said about a national dialogue. You're talking about a one-on-one employer-employee relationship, and a lot can be said about that. But there is also, in the space between the three of us sitting here and all of the thousands of people who listen to this show, are asking themselves, what does this mean for me at the end of the month, at the end of the year, and in context and relation to what I can do every day? So just your final thoughts, what does this mean? Today, tomorrow, end of the month, end of the year, can an ordinary South African do anything about this, or we're just waiting to be washed over by this tide that's flowing?
You have agency. And the best person to determine what is good for Pumi and her son is Pumi, not a government bureaucrat or a politician or the two of us, you. And what do you need? You need choices. You need more money in your back pocket. You need the freedom to be able to start a business and the certainty to know that your assets are going to be protected in the future, because you're not just worried about tomorrow or next week or next month or next year even. You're worried about 2-3 decades in the future. Is this country going to be a place where you can raise your child and knowing that they're going to be safe and secure and have the same opportunities that you've had? So what we need is more freedom for individuals in South Africa. That's fundamentally what the Free Market Foundation is advocating. Yes, we want to see capital flow into this country, but ultimately it's in service of empowering people to be self-actualized agents. The government's not going to do that for you. You have to seize that opportunity yourself. So, and I think civil society organizations like the FMF play a critical role in holding the government to account and advocating for alternative policies that a lot of other political parties are not advocating for. So that is my message to you. State-proof yourself. Don't believe some of the lies that are told by politicians who have their own interests at heart. Start to build power outside of the state. Insulate yourself from some of these risks. But ultimately, these big national questions like the debt, what does it mean, 76% debt-to-GDP ratio? That is an intergenerational wealth expropriation. Basically, that is the politicians and the elites today stealing money from our children in the future, because the next generation, and I have a child who's coming next month, my first child, that generation is going to have to be dealing with the problems that we created. So I think we should be helping the next generation by trying to front load the pain and saying, what can we do to solve these problems now, not in the future? And that's why I think this week was a good, it was a wake up call, because we were sleepwalking our way to a fiscal cliff. We need to say, actually, it's time to get real. We need to cut back on this needless spending. We need to have a small, lean government, and we need to encourage entrepreneurship in this country so that we can start to lower unemployment and improve fixed capital formation, that hard investment. So
but
that,
I can't
that's
do that in
message.
My house, okay? I yeah. can't do that in my house.
Look, the choices we make matter.
Yeah.
Who we decide to lead us matter, and leadership matters. As I indicated earlier, when we had good leadership in this country, we saw the results, good results. Employment was going down. We managed to pay off apartheid debt from this economy through the decisions that were made by the leaders at the time. Local elections are not far away in 2026. The choices we make as to who leads us in our areas do matter. But there's also some things that we must change. We know the political and electoral system is not working for us. We know the dominant players are political parties, and they didn't cover themselves in glory yesterday, including the DA. Because, by the way, a budget that's placed before Parliament is a proposal. It could have been amended both in the Council as well as in the House. That could have been done. You know, it would have given our supposed representative, the MPs, a little bit more power over the executive in terms of what goes on into that budget. But of course, the party leaders decided, those that are in the GNU, that are going to have a side discussion so they come back with something that they have reached consensus on. And we hope Parliament will be strong enough to be able to say, we want a budget that speaks to our people's needs. And on that note, I also want to say that, you know, getting that national dialogue going so that we can deal with some of the structural issues that we find ourselves with, where, for instance, parties are deciding for us who should actually represent us and where we don't have constituencies, is something that we need to put to rectify as ordinary people. We can't allow decisions of the big people, you know, to be deciding our lives. We need to stand up, to be counted ourselves. We need to have our voice heard. That's where I'll stop. Thank you.
My question to the audience and to everyone here is, do we want to be a rich country or do we want to be a poor country? That is the binary choice. And unfortunately, on the trajectory that we're on, we're going to stay a poor country. We've got some advantages here, like minerals and so on. But the choice is ours. And we are choosing to be poor right now.
I don't think anyone chooses to be poor, David. We are a rich country. So is this continent. It has been exploited over many years. And we need to change that relationship with the first or developed world. And we are hoping vehicles like the BRICS will help us to get there. Mm. So that's what I'll say. We are not poor.
Think of the Democratic Republic of Congo. There is no country on earth that has a richer mineral endowment than the DRC. And they've had independence since when? Since the 1960s.
Oh, well, we can have a conversation about the various players and who did what to whom.
On a per capita, basis, they are poor.
You know, and this is why, for me, I like having conversations like this, because I think conversations like this are not just about what's happening today, but also what's happened in the past and how we move forward. And that's why I don't like having binary conversations, right? I don't think everything is a zero-sum game. I'm glad you raised the Congo as the last place to be, because I think the information we have today about what has transpired in the Congo and the various players, I've been thinking a lot about that and what happened when they went to the polls and when they made their decision and when bigger players, other countries, decided to exercise their strongman mentality over that particular country, and that the will of those people was not the right way as they saw it, and therefore were happy to deploy as we know today. Not just mercenaries, but also assassins, to change what the will of the people in that country had been. And today, here in South Africa, we see a very similar thing play out, where we have citizens of this country not having conversations with each other and with the government to say, how do we move forward, not in a binary conversation, but in a conversation that involves all of us and is not just a zero-sum game that says, in order for me to win, you have to lose, and therefore implore other governments and other states to intervene against the will of the many, which is what we keep getting told. The thing about democracy, which is what we all have bought into, that it is the will of the many who vote, and those individuals that they put into the positions of power where they have the pen to sign those legislative amendments. When some people are unhappy about them, they are happy to go to other governments to say, we are not happy and we want it changed and you change it for us. And speaking about the Congo, where America and their president felt that this particular president that the people of the Congo want is not the right person, and they were happy to deploy assassins, not just to kill the man, but to kill the man and therefore put his body in a vat of acid so that there is nothing but his teeth left, which they kept as trophies, is abhorrible. And I think we should learn from that.
My point is, there is no country, you'd struggle to think of a country in the world with a richer mineral endowment. Even if you think of, all of the history, and Belgian colonialism was brutal there. But the regime of the regime of Mobutu was also brutal, and the Kabilas, they were also pretty brutal.
So, with the intervention of America, as we know today, as fact.
Yeah, if you're in these countries and you don't take instructions from the big brothers, you're gone. So the wealth of those countries, including ours, has not really served its people. And that's what we need to change. South Africa since 1652 has been treated literally as an asset of a corporation. Mm-hmm. Those corporations never went away. and some of them have morphed into Freedom, a free market foundation. So, what we need is we need the world of this country to start serving our people, and the voice of our people in terms of the choices that they want to make must be amplified. I think both capital and government has really had enough to say, and as we have seen yesterday, they're not doing
covering themselves in glory.
So you talk about zero sum, Pumi. The ultimate positive sum game is economic growth. And how do you get to economic growth? Through capitalism. It is the greatest driver of prosperity the world has ever seen. And it has fundamentally transformed the fate of billions of people.
Tell us about China. I mean, 400 million people taken out of poverty by a very strong government supported by SOEs.
Same strong government also ended up causing the deaths of 60 million people through the Great Leap Forward. But how did they reverse? Deng Xiaoping do? He embraced market capitalism. He said, it doesn't matter if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. And they joined the World Trade Organization.
Some of the biggest corporations in the world are Chinese state-owned companies. In fact, Aramco, which is Saudi Arabian, is a state-owned company. So as you correctly put it, that cat can be a capitalist, it can be a socialist, as long as it serves the interests
of the people. As long as it catches the mice.
The problem is socialism often serves the interests of a very tiny fraction of the population.
No, that's not true.
Because I think we do have to, and I love the idea of new ideas and new people being part of the conversation, and as many people as possible being part of the conversation, as you correctly say, David, is that Pumi knows what is right for Pumi. And I think when there are 62 million such individuals, it's important to have it's important to have an opportunity to hear those voices and find different ways. And I don't think it's in the left or in the right. I think it is part of various places where the answers are going to come from. I don't think they are going to come from capitalism, and I don't think they're going to come from socialism. But we have to find a way to make the things that work for the people.
Exactly.
Capitalism is freedom. Freedom to choose the life that you want. To choose who you trade with, what kind of business you have, who you employ, to save, to have access to markets, to be able to offer something to the world of value and be rewarded for that. That is a beautiful thing.
Business,
that is the only way you progress.
Business doesn't operate in a vacuum. It's part of a community. It gets given its license to operate by the community. It cannot only serve the interest of the owner. It has to serve the interest of everyone. And that's the point. What you are asking for through, and there's this obsession with markets, like it's if markets are efficient, that they're the best distributors of resources. They are not. There has to be some government involvement in this. Because government, what it does, implements rules that we have all agreed. We said, you are a representative. We said, we like your manifesto in terms of how you say this country should be run. So use those rules to regulate how all of us behave. You can't have a carte blanche system.
So you have to ask permission now.
How a carte blanche system, those of us that have had the misfortune spending some of our youth on farms, know what happens on farms, you know. So what we don't want, South Africa to be a plantation again.
I think what I'm going to end at is that I don't think that the solution is an either-or solution. I think that there is a third way that we should all be looking for and working towards. And rather than saying they are wrong or they are right, saying how can we all benefit? But thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time and coming out. It's always stimulating conversation. I absolutely love when you have people who come from different places but actually agree. Because the two of you agree that we have to find ways that will work for the many of our people and not just the few who you call whatever, whether you call them elites or whether you call them the politically connected or the capitalists or the socialists. I like the idea of what we need is we need a cat that catches the mouse, and the mouse that we need to catch and kill is one of unemployment. The more people we can get to be economically viable and in our economy, then gives us an opportunity to lift all our people out of poverty. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Bumi.